This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
Hi everyone, hope you're enjoying the conference. My name's Annette. I'm a guide dog handler from New South Wales. I have three dogs. One is a guide dog, one's retired, and one's just a pet dog. So I have a huge interest, and also because my human children have left home, I have a huge interest in enriching the lives of my dogs. And I think as guide dog handlers, we're really lucky. We get to take our dogs everywhere and they already have a very enriched life because they're coming everywhere with us and they get to see new things all the time. We ask a lot of them, or at least I do ask a lot of my dog. And I think it's really important that we also allow the dog to be a dog. I'm sure that they don't always see their work as work in the same way that we might, but enriching their lives is really important. So for today's segment, we've got two speakers. The first one is Melinda Bowden, who is a guide dog mobility instructor from Guide Dogs New South Wales. She has quite a keen interest in dog enrichment as well. And the other speaker is Joyce Jones, who Joyce told me yesterday that she has been a guide dog handler since 1974, which is amazing. So she obviously has lots of experience with dogs as well. So I'm going to invite them both to speak. We're going to start the session with an overview of guide dog enrichment from Melinda. She's going to tell us what it is, what it isn't, and all the things that we need to know. Then we'll hand over to Joyce, and Joyce is going to talk about some of the ways that we enrich our dogs' lives already, just in the daily things that we do. And then we'll also, Melinda and I and Joyce will also discuss some of the things that we can actively do to, you know, help our dogs relax and enjoy their lives. So I'll hand over to Melinda now to give us an overview of what canine enrichment is. Thanks, Melinda.
Thanks, Annette, and thanks DGHA for inviting me to speak today on enrichment. It's a topic I'm really excited to be able to talk about, and I encourage you all to have a think about not only your guide dogs that you're currently working, but retired guides and pet dogs as well. Like Annette said, she's got all three at home, and this topic definitely applies to all of them. So there's a few things around enrichment, and like Annette said, I'm going to start with some definitions and a bit of a broader explanation around some of the theory, and then we'll move on to some more concrete examples, and encourage you all to ask questions, any ideas you might have, things that you do to share with the group as well. So my favourite definition of enrichment actually comes from a place called barkersize.com. If you ever get the opportunity to have a bit of a look there, they've got some great ideas around enrichment. And I particularly love the name as well. And they state that it's additions to a dog's environment and lifestyle that the dog interacts with, and as a result, experiences improved physical and psychological health. I think that's really important because we're talking not just about how the dog feels from an emotional perspective, but also how healthy they are. And we know that if a dog is healthy from both a psychological perspective and a physical perspective, they'll probably work longer as a guide. And hopefully we get better outcomes for our guide work, but also for their life. So there's five main categories of enrichment that we talk about: social enrichment, physical, cognitive, which when we talk about cognitive, we're talking about the mental stimulation, which training can be a part of and your guide work can be a part of, food and sensory. Now, we'll circle back to these later and we'll talk about specific examples around each of these, but it's rarely this tidy. It's rarely so clean that an activity will fall neatly into one of these categories. So an example of that is that if we use food enrichment and the dog is using their nose to find that food, that enrichment activity can be categorized as both sensory because they're using their nose, but also food. There's other things that we can do, activities that may be both cognitive and sensory. So even though the theory says it falls neatly into five categories, it's probably not quite that easy in real life. And it doesn't really matter too much, but having a bit of a note of those five different categories can give you the opportunity to brainstorm some ideas and to make sure that we're doing things that is across the breadth of the enrichment, rather than all of our energies being focused just on social enrichment or just on food enrichment. So what are the benefits of enrichment for our dogs and for us? So there's quite a few different benefits. Into the science of how some of it works. We'll talk more about benefits later as well. But the main ones are that enrichment can prevent boredom and therefore undesirable behaviours. So things like barking, destructiveness, particularly when dogs are left alone. And I'm not talking about from a separation anxiety perspective, but just more from a boredom, dogs not having a job perspective. So some enrichment ideas for retired guides who are used to going out and about, or dog guides that are being left behind because you don't need them that particular day, then enrichment activities can be really helpful to prevent undesirable behaviours. It can allow for undesirable behaviours, particularly natural and instinctive ones, to occur in our preferred format. So what I mean by that is things like digging, chewing, sniffing, scavenging, all the things that we don't want to happen in our households, or particularly in harness. We can actually allow for these undesirable behaviours to be expressed by the dog in a way that we want it to, not for it to just come out because the dog has a desire to practice these instinctive behaviours. Other benefits of enrichment are it can actually improve problem-solving skills and build confidence in dogs. If you're doing either cognitive enrichment activities or food sensory activities, dogs can actually improve their problem-solving skills and gain confidence in their ability to come up with a solution. And that could only be good for guide work as well. It can improve the dog-human relationship. So new guides or really at any stage in your relationship, if you're seen as the provider of good things and things that dog genuinely enjoys, that's relationship building for you. And the last benefit, which I don't think, we should underplay, is that it's enjoyable for the dog. It's nice. We all want to do things that are nice, that feel good, and enrichment activities can do that for us. So I wouldn't be a GDMI if I didn't take the fun out of this session by talking about all the problems and dangers that we can create around enrichment. But seriously, I do want to address some of these things because some of them either have a safety implication or they might be the reason that you haven't tried some enrichment activities before with your dog. So I want to address some of these because some of them have workarounds and they might empower you to try some of these ideas that we talk about today, some suggestions that Joyce will bring up or that other members might suggest as well. So the list of the bewares. So beware frustration. One thing that enrichment is supposed to do is enhance the psychological well-being of a dog, not to reduce it. So if you're completing an activity or you're giving your dog an enrichment opportunity and your dog is becoming significantly frustrated, then it's not the right activity for your dog, or probably more accurately, it's not at the right level of difficulty. So some of the things that we're going to talk about later as suggestions may actually be an end goal. So that might be where you're going to end up. And there might be many little steps along the way that you need to break it down into so your dog can learn the activity. It's okay to work up to things, increasing the difficulty over time. So things that we'll probably reference will be around things like nose work or food puzzles, where if we go in with an expectation that our dog will complete a task successfully at the beginning, they may become frustrated and actually disengaged, which is not enriching. Which leads me to the next one, which is not all things are for all dogs, or all people really. So enrichment needs to be something that your dog enjoys, genuinely enjoys. So not something that you wish your dog enjoyed or even something that you think that they enjoy and they don't. Probably for me, the best example of this would be social enrichment. So more so dog-dog interactions. Sometimes we really want our dogs to play with dogs. It feels good for us. And not all of our dogs are doggy dogs. Some of them are the introverts of the dog world. They're actually quite happy with our company, or a really small select group of friends. So just keeping an eye on any enrichment activities you're doing, making sure that you're really doing it for the dog, and that it's something that they really want to do. Being careful in multi-dog households, if an item or an activity is highly enriching for a dog, and there's the threat of that being taken away, this can lead to a thing called resource guarding, which is basically aggression focused on maintaining access to that resource. So you know your dog best, you know your group of dogs best if you do have a multi-dog household. But sometimes prevention is the best thing. It's better than fixing it later. It's better than the cure. So often the simplest, safest and absolute best rule of thumb is to at minimum have a physical barrier between your dog or your multiple dogs, your dog and that's participating in the enrichment activity. This just takes away the stress of that dog feeling like they have to protect the thing that they really like and they're really enjoying. They don't feel the need to make sure that they have to take steps so that they don't lose it to the other dog. Obviously, there's enrichment activities where dogs can participate together. It will depend on the dogs themselves. It'll also depend on just the value. How high value is that activity to that dog? Now, I mean this in the nicest possible way, and I mean it as the mother of an 18-month-old, but any children under high school age pretty much consider it a multi-dog household. So cute children can be unpredictable. They can want to play with the dog and they can want to take the things that the dog is enjoying. So again, if it's something that the dog's really enjoying, it's food related, it could be a toy too. Keeping children separate from dogs when they're participating in really, really high value enrichment activities is a really easy and safe thing to do. Other things to be aware of is this morning Anna was talking about clicker training and about reinforcement and talking about if we want to strengthen the behaviour, then we give the dog something that they enjoy after they've done the behaviour that you want. So providing enrichment immediately after your dog is hassling you for the enrichment. So in probably circumstances like at work, if you're at work or you're working from home or you've got the dog, you know, under your desk and your actual goal is for that dog to be nice and settled and quiet, waiting until your dog hassles you and bugs you and then thinking, oh yeah, that's right, maybe now's time for some enrichment to entertain you, isn't always the best of ideas, particularly not if you do that pattern often. The dog will eventually learn that they can access the enrichment by doing undesirable behaviours. So if you can, trying to get in first, offer enrichment when your dog's in a good place, when they're settled, before you feel the need to occupy them. The other, I've got a quite long list, don't I, really, about all these don'ts, but we'll get to the fun bit, I promise. Another thing, though, is ingestion risk. So Labradors are fantastic at eating things that they shouldn't. And just because it's a, quote, inedible object does not mean they're not going to try it. I speak from experience and from knowing a lot of Labradors. So there are some enrichment activities that really should only be supervised because of that risk. If you're doing unsupervised food enrichment activities, you need to know that you've eliminated the risk of possible foreign body ingestion. If dogs ingest something and it doesn't pass through, it's a very expensive and potentially deadly experience for your dog. So if you're buying toys or food puzzles, look for labels like Power Chewer, or in the case of Kong products, Kong Extreme. The Kong products tend to be black in colour, as they are more likely to suit our Labradors out there. There are three typical chewer categories with items on sale: gentle, average, and power chewers. Now, the bad news is that the power chewer ones are generally more expensive than the gentle chewer ones, but they will last you longer and they're never going to be more expensive than open abdominal surgery to remove an obstruction. It's also important to buy the right size. So again, smaller ones are typically cheaper, but the consequences are expensive. So for our Labradors or Golden Retrievers or Crosses, typically large products or more likely extra large products, for example, in the classic Kong products, would be the size that we'd be looking for. Beware of weight gain. So all food enrichment should really be in place of your dog's meal, not as well as. So one of the goals of enrichment that we said was to actually enhance physical health as well as psychological health. And an overweight dog doesn't enhance physical health. So one easy way to do this is to go all in and provide your dog's meal allowance through a food enrichment activity at mealtime. If you do that, you won't be tempted to still feed them at another time. It's completely okay to throw away your silver bowl and only ever provide meals via food enrichment. But what you don't want to be doing is providing food enrichment and a full ration meal. So keeping an eye on your dog's weight, if you're starting to introduce food enrichment is a good thing to do. So one of the reasons that people tend to be a bit reluctant about enrichment activities and particularly probably food enrichment and sensory enrichment such as nose work would be the question about what about introducing problems into guide work. So isn't this a danger? What won't I teach my dog to scent in harness because I'm providing experiences and opportunities to do things like nose work? Won't my dog learn to scavenge even in harness if I provide food enrichment from the ground? And these are really great questions and great things to think about, because if we think about them, we can mitigate the risk. So you can minimize this risk. There's a concept in animal learning called discrimination. Now, this isn't what we were just talking about in terms of discrimination and what we would usually think about. What it means instead is that your dog can discriminate or tell the difference between different stimuli or things around them in order to determine when to perform a behavior and when not to. So this is how your dog can perform traffic work and stop when a car crosses your path, but is also still able to cross in front of idling cars at a traffic light. It's also why rewarding your dog for a sit doesn't mean your dog will never be able to stand again. So our dogs discriminate all the time between things, between greeting people in your household and your family and not trying to solicit attention when they're out guiding, why they can play with dogs at home or in other places, but won't attempt to do it in harness. So our dogs are actually really clever and really good at this discrimination. So we can do two main things that will allow any enrichment activities to not cross over into guide work. So one of the first and probably most important thing is continue to have the same expectations of your dog in harness. So this alone will remind your dog what is and isn't a permissible activity in harness and guiding. And then the second thing you can do is create a set of circumstances during enrichment activities that's unique and that differs from circumstances during guide work. So your dog will then learn these circumstances, or in the training world we call them stimuli, and that these occur during enrichment time, and behaviours that are usually not okay, like sniffing or eating food off the ground, are actually okay in these circumstances. So think about Melinda, this as the...
Melinda, we've got about 4 minutes left.
Excellent, thank you. Okay. So you can think about this as the opposite of putting it on your dog's harness. It's like an ununiform, I'm going to call it. So things you can do is you can introduce a cue word that's nowhere near any of your guide work cues. So if you want to set up a food enrichment and you want your dog to go and pick up food off the ground, instead of saying find the food, because that's so closely linked to our other keywords, you might say something like go seek, which might be completely different. The other thing that you can do is you can introduce equipment or the lack of. And what I mean by lack of is, you know, don't have your dog on leash, don't have your dog in their harness, obviously. But you can introduce novel equipment like a walking harness or a bandana or a coat or something, just something different that really clearly indicates to your dog that an enrichment activity is about to begin and different behaviours are okay. These are only important if there's a behaviour that's in conflict with your expectations during guide work. But I do know that some people feel much more comfortable having guidelines like this in place to allow dogs access to natural behaviours. There is, the last thing I wanted to say was that it's valid to have some concerns about enrichment activities affecting guide work, but there's also a second thought about that, which is if we give our dogs the opportunity to satiate, so become satisfied with things like sniffing and food outside of their work, then they may be less likely to do those behaviours inside their work because they've already become satisfied from that opportunity of that that scent or nose work enrichment. So that's it from me for the moment. Thanks, Annette. Hopefully I'm
Thanks,
on time.
Linda. Thanks very much. That was really interesting. There's so many, you know, different things to think about when it comes to, you know, engaging our dogs in, you know, stuff that's fun for them. So now I will hand over to Joyce, who is going to talk about some of the ways that we just naturally enrich our dog's life. And by, you know, being aware of these things, we can actually make a little bit more effort and make them more enriching. So over to you, Joyce.
Thanks, Annette. I recommend all of the things that people know about, you know, the rugs and the mats and the coats and the special toys and all that sort of thing and the eating treats and so on. But I've been using guide dogs since 1974 and I've had 9 altogether and bad luck with a couple of them who died early of pancreatitis and things like that. But with the dogs that I've had since I've been in Toowoomba, their lives have been greatly enriched by being befriended by families who live around me, people that I get around with at Labor Party and that type of thing, who come and take them for the day or take them for an afternoon and take them to parks where they can just run around with other dogs and go back to these families' homes and meet up with their dogs and their visitors and that type of thing. So they've got that life away from my home here, which they might get, you know, once or twice a week. And when they come home, they are just so uplifted by the whole thing. You know, I can just tell by the way they walk and the way they communicate with one another and that type of thing, that they really do benefit from that being important to another home outside this one. That sort of thing is not accessible to all people with guide dogs. It certainly wasn't accessible to me when I had my early dogs. It's just something that I've more or less struck since I've been living up here in Toowoomba. And I would certainly recommend that to the guide dog training schools and also to this organisation, that perhaps if people are having trouble with a guide dog and they're having trouble with their frustrations and behavioural problems and that sort of thing, to see if there isn't a voluntary service available where someone else could come and take the dog for a run in the park or a walk in the park and just get away from the being in the one place all the time with the one person. I just think that you know, the effect that it has on my dogs, the last dogs that I've had, the last 5 of them have all had a retired dog to come home to, and the love that they've had for one another and the games that they play together and that type of thing has really made life much better for the new guide dog. But this business of being friends with another family, I don't know how other people feel about that, but I really do think that it does give them another dimension to their lives. And so I'd just like to throw that out as a topic for discussion as well. So back to you, Annette. I don't know how other people feel about that one, but it might be a bit of a controversial issue.
Thank you, Joyce. Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that I've actually done is I put it out there on my local, one of the local Facebook groups, and I ended up finding a friend actually who has a property who I occasionally take my dogs out there and just let them run free. That it was a fairly well enclosed area. Sorry, not enclosed, but fenced, and it was probably about 1 or 2 acres. I'm really reluctant to take my dogs to public dog parks just because of the poo situation that is not handled very well by councils and other dogs that might be there. So I think, yeah, letting them have a free run somewhere safe is a really good idea. I also just want to answer, and Melinda, please feel free to step in here. Sorry, what was the question? Suggestions for dinner enrichment. Melinda has already mentioned throwing away the bowls. And this is something I do regularly for my dogs, probably, yeah, most of the time in summer and probably a little bit less often in winter, is that I just throw their food out on the ground and they have to go and find it. Like, I don't throw it for miles, but probably would throw it in a good square meter or two. And it actually slows down the eating rate. I've got one dog that eats really, really fast. She almost chokes on her food. So it's really good for her because they can only pick up one or two pieces of kibble at a time. So that's a really good thing to do as an enrichment thing for meals, for dinner.
That's an excellent suggestion.
Sorry,
Annette. I was just going to say that's an excellent suggestion, the scatter feeding, because as dogs sniff to locate the food, it activates a thing in their brain called the seeking system. And the seeking system is actually proven to increase the feel-good hormones of dopamine and serotonin in the dogs. And it can actually counteract the stress hormones as well, like cortisol.
Yep, excellent. Okay, sorry, I'm just looking to see. I think there was another question. Oh, no, it's a...
While you're having a look at that, I can add a few other ideas as well to Stacey's suggestions for dinner time. There's a thing called a snuffle mat, which you can either purchase or you can actually make them yourselves. It's pretty much a toy. It's on a mat and it's got these long pieces of fabric that you can scatter food into, so the dry kibble through, and the dogs have to really work to get to it. And interestingly, in the animal world, there's a concept called contra freeloading, which means that if an animal is offered a choice between being provided free food, so food that they can just access, or food that they have to, that requires effort to obtain, like a game like this, they actually prefer the food that requires effort. They'll actually run past an open bowl of food in order to access something like a snuffle mat or scatter feeding or the Kongs with frozen food in them. Or things similar to that.
That's interesting. That must be like what they're just wired to do, because I guess in the wild they would have had to catch their food, wouldn't they? I wonder if that comes.
Yeah, and funnily, it's actually for everything. So lots of studies and lots of good videos on things like crows and squirrels and animals like that doing it as well. It's because you get this double reward. So you get the food, but you also get that dopamine and serotonin releases as well. People are a little bit the same. You know, you do hobbies for the joy of it and for what it gives you, not just the product that you get at the end of it.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. And so so we also had planned to talk about some of the enrichment toys and games that are available. A couple of the ones that I use are, we all know about Kong toys that you can, freeze, like wet your kibble and freeze it inside the Kong. And that's, you know, a game that, well, with my dogs, it lasts about 20 minutes, but some dogs it can last longer. There's also a thing, I'm going to hold one up, but I'll also give a description. It's called a Kong Genius, and it's a rubbery kind of toy, fairly hard rubber, and it's got a round belly part, and it's kind of shaped like an urn, I guess. It's got a round belly kind of part and then a longer part at the top, which also has a hole in it. And it has a hole in it that's shaped like a cross. And you can push food through this hole. So I put sometimes cheese, chopped up pieces of carrot or celery. The cross is a little bit too big for kibble, well, the kibble that I feed anyway. And the dogs have to get the food out of this. You can also put peanut butter in it. So it's kind of like a normal Kong, but it's a little bit harder to get the food out of it. And I find that this prolongs the entertainment value of it just because it's harder to get the food out. There's also another ball, another thing that you can buy. I'm pretty sure it's called a Holy Roller, and it's a round ball. Obviously, it's going to be round if it's a ball. And it has more holes than ball, if that makes sense. So it's kind of got big holes all the way around it. And what you can do with that, I think there's a few different games you can play with that. One of the ones I do is I get old hand towels or old pieces of fabric, like maybe they're old tea towels or something, ones that you know, it's okay if they get chewed up. I roll them in a circular kind of way to with food inside them, and then I thread them through the holes in this ball, and the dog has to then get the fabric out of the ball and find, you know, either chew through it or unravel the fabric to get the treats out. And I find that's, you know, that's my dogs are big chewers, and they do go through things very quickly. And I found this to be one of the most long-term kind of, like, it might keep one dog, you know, happy for an hour or so. And I think also, Melinda, we were going to talk a little bit about nose work. Would you like to talk about nose work?
Yeah, sure. So nose work, officially it's a dog sport, which actually mimics scent detection dog tasks. I'm waiting for the dog sport that comes out that mimics guide dog tasks. But it's basically training pet dogs to do scent detection tasks. It starts usually with them locating food, and this is what I referenced earlier, that it's not, things aren't, you know, super tidy between things just being scent enrichment or just food. They're often a bit of both. So usually dogs are taught over the first few lessons how to target a scent, by getting them to find food that they already know and that they like, and then they move on to targeting actual scents. So the scents are planted under either cardboard boxes or in containers or in vials, and you can actually do it via commercial trainers as a recreational activity for dogs. So there's a group, I'm not sure if you have any other information about other people in it, but there's a group particularly called Canine Nose Work, which is a capital K and the number 9. That's a trademark group who do nose work training. And there's groups kind of all over Australia. So you can always look that up online and see if there's anyone near you or if there's a trainer who's qualified to do scent work, work with you. And the idea is that the dogs learn how to alert to scents and to seek them out. And while they're seeking those scents out, they're hopefully de-stressing, they're using their nose, and they're having an enjoyable activity.
Yeah, and it's in my experience, I've done quite a bit of scent work with my retired guide dog. It's absolutely exhausting for them. It's kind of like, you know, when you take the kids to the park and have a really, really good play and they come home, they're so satisfied and exhausted. It's you know, it's what dogs are built to do, use their nose. So it's kind of like, you know, such a really good enrichment activity for them. And I have talked about this in other places as well. And I have been asked, you know, if the dogs are trained to find a particular scent, and usually the scents that you would use are birch and the other one has escaped me. I can't remember the other one that you use, but they're kind of like essential oils. You know, would they respond to that if they came across it in a shop? As a guide dog, would they respond to it if they came across it somewhere else? But as Melinda mentioned earlier, dogs are really good at discriminating. So I've actually trained my dogs to find Vegemite in the backyard. I put it on little bits of sticky tape so they can barely see it. I might put it up a tree or up on the clothesline or something, and they still find it. And yet when I, you know, have Vegemite on toast for breakfast, they don't react to that because they know that that's completely out of context. But, you know, when I use the term go seek so that they know it's a completely different game, but they absolutely get that that's the game, just in the same way that they get, you know, when they've got a harness on, they're there to do a job as well. So I think we might just open up the floor to any questions. Oh, actually, there are some questions here. Sorry. Licky mats also, absolutely. And there are food puzzles and puzzle bowls that you can get as well, which the puzzle bowls are really good for slowing down fast eaters. That's a bowl that has like grooves in it where the food would sit. It's the food isn't just in the bowl in one big lump as it normally is. So that slows down their eating. Stacey, I was told by my trainer that I was the enrichment, and that is absolutely true. Love that comment. Nicole, you can connect other Kong geniuses together through the X holes. So the end result is a multi-interconnected Kong toy. Absolutely. I actually don't have those, but yes, I believe that is a really good toy. One of the things I do like about those Kong geniuses is that I occasionally throw them as you would throw a ball for my dogs, and they bounce off in all sorts of different directions. And this can be good and bad, but I have to say my dogs absolutely love the randomness of chasing them as well. So they're pretty versatile toys.
Stun toys as well. If you can do a bit of keep a bit of a toy rotation, if you've got more than one toy, if you've got, you know, quite a few toys, instead of leaving them all out all the time, even if it's their favourite toy, put it away for a while. If you can do a toy rotation every few days or once a week, and you might have two or three sets of toys, just the novelty, the newness of it coming back out again sometimes is enough to provide a bit of enrichment to them. We often think having more toys out all the time is more powerful, but sometimes the novelty is actually is better and a bit more fun.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. I used to do that with my kids as well. I would put the toys away for a couple of months and then get them out, and it was like Christmas. just a comment here from Anna, who spoke earlier. It's very helpful when our dogs can enjoy enrichment that does not solely revolve around us, to assist with their confidence and attachment. We can be the providers of enrichment, but also giving them skills of independence when they can enjoy their food puzzles without us. Absolutely. That's a great point, Anna. Thank you. Okay, any more questions or anything that you would like to add, Joyce or Melinda?
No, nothing.
Oh, and Claudia has her hand up. Sorry, Claudia.
That's okay. I just wanted to say that you can also use a towel, so like a hand towel, even a bath towel, or, you know, a tea towel. And you can actually put food in that and then roll it up and then, teach your dog to unroll the tea towel. And then if they get that, then you can, like, start tying it in knots and adding, you know, extra sort of, twists and turns to it. But, you know, that's it's something cheap that you don't actually have to buy, or you can buy a towel from the op shop or something like that. So you don't always have to spend a lot of money on buying, you know, toys and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. And that's toilet rolls suggestion. Are really good too. I haven't done this for a long time, but I used to get a Tupperware container, and I'd put I'd sort of fill it with toilet rolls standing on their end. So maybe about six toilet rolls, and then I'd put a piece of kibble in the bottom of each of the toilet rolls, and the dog had to figure out how to get to the kibble, and whether that meant tipping the whole thing over or chewing through the toilet rolls. It was, you know, a bit of a problem solving game for the dog, and, you know, cost nothing because we all have toilet rolls, especially during COVID. So
thanks, Claudia.
It's Greg here. I just got a question around the dog dog chews, and, you know, I've got two. One's made out of wood, one's made out of plastic. It's a hard plastic. And I'm just wondering, with the plastics, we hear a lot about microplastics these days. Is there certain ones that you should avoid when you're looking for these types of chews?
Good question.
That's a good question. I haven't heard any concerns or evidence in the dog world around the plastics. In terms of things you should be looking for, it would be, for me, the safety aspect of it not being ingestible. So the the hard one that you probably have would be something similar to a Nyla bone or a tasty bone is my guess. And they're quite good for the dogs, quite good for their teeth health, and actually a bit less likely to chip teeth on that than things like real bones. So they're actually a great toy. You can get ones that have flavouring in them or kind of like a fake beef marrow up the middle that make them a bit more of a food thing if you've got a dog that's not a super chewer as well. So, yeah, good question. I'll look that up, but I certainly haven't heard any information coming out about plastics being a concern for dog above and beyond ingestion.
Cool. Thanks, Melinda, and thanks, Greg. Kirsten also has her hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to make a comment for one of the things I do with my dog is the snuffle mat. Found it to be quite good for that. And for those who don't know, it's a mat and it's got like all these sort of holes and difficult things that the dog has to try and work around. So using their sense of smell and things to try and find very, very, very well spread out small pieces of kibble.
Yes. I just want to add something to that as well. Where I live in Dubbo, we have it's like a sheltered workshop, I guess you would call it, except I don't think it is called a sheltered workshop, but they do craft lessons there for the people that use that service. It's called Breakthrough, actually, and I think it's, you know, all over Australia, and that one of the lessons they do is a sewing lesson where they do things with fabrics. And I actually had one of the class make a snuffle mat for me. They just got the, you know, because you can make snuffle mats at home really easily. You just get a rubber mat that has sort of a grid shape and you cut short pieces, or actually probably not short pieces, maybe 10 or 15 centimeter pieces.
They're reasonable length.
Fabric, yeah. And then you tie them onto that grid shape and it makes like a nice furry kind of mat, like a shag pile kind of mat, and that's where you hide the food in between those things. So that's basically what a snuffle mat is. I had these students make me one, which was really nice, and my dogs love it to death. So
yes, yeah. Mine takes a solid half hour. Another trick I use, especially in summer on boiling hot days, is frozen Kongs.
Yes, definitely.
Oh, that occupies her for a solid.
And you can do those with, like, I usually do the frozen Kongs, and there's also little ball-shaped molds you can get from Target. And I usually just do those with vegetables so that we're not, you know, putting weight on the dogs. I usually just process food, you know, in a food processor, make it all gooey, throw it in the freezer, and they love those in summer. So yeah, thanks, Kirsten. Now have I got everybody? Brooke and Letitia, oops, sorry, the writing keeps moving as people make comments. Classic Kongs, make sure they have a hole at the top and the bottom, and the cheaper ones only have one hole. The dog's tongue can get stuck due to the suction not being able to be released. And that's really important also with, you know, just the normal Kongs. You always have to leave both of those holes a little bit open so that, you know, you don't create a suction situation. Melinda, a muffin tin with tennis balls in the holes and kibble underneath. Some of the tennis balls is an inexpensive and food puzzle too. Just beware the clever Labradors who flip it over so they don't have to search for the ball, search underneath the ball for the food. Nicole, Vegemite Isopols are great in summer. Absolutely. And Nadia, even just a frozen ice block made in an ice cream container with yogurt, carrot, etc. frozen, then knock it out of the container and let them kill it. Love it. Thanks, guys. I think, unless there's any more, I think that's about it for this session.
I've got one, and it's more of a statement, and it sort of fits into the dog enrichment, I suppose. About a year ago, we had to replace our 50-year-old mattress, our own bed, and we went with a mob called Sleeping Duck. And the reason we did was because they had dog beds that actually match the mattress, the same color and all that. And although probably a little bit on the expensive side, they're very, very well made. They've got a cover that you can unzip and wash. So, and the mattress itself is a couple of inches thick. Plus there's an edge all around the outside. They can stick their head up on it. And Memphis absolutely loves his.
That sounds great. That sounds really good. Thanks, Greg. Okay. Is there anything else? Melinda, Joyce, anyone else? Any more ideas, input? No? Well, that sounds like it. Thank you, everyone, for your input and your ideas. Thank you, Melinda and Joyce, for giving up your time to come and share your knowledge and experience with us. And I think that's it for this session.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website, www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?